You're listening to episode 45 of the Mad Chatters Podcast, August 5th, 2015.
Most everyone's mad here.
Welcome back to another episode of the Mad Chatters Podcast, your very important date with the happenings at Walt Disney World and around the Disney universe.
So important.
Very, very important date. My name's Derek, and I'm joined by my fellow co-host, Matthew.
Good day.
And Jeremy's back.
Yay.
Thank you. It's good to be back. I missed you all. And to my legion of fans out there, have no fear. I have returned. Darken on. There we go. No, I did miss you all. I missed being with you last week, but I really enjoyed last week's show. So
okay, good.
Yes, good job, it was guys. Good.
Yeah, we had a good time.
It kind of concerned me because I was like, if they can do the show well without me, what does that mean when contract negotiations come up? But
let's talk to our lawyer.
Your 1 week suspension is over for. For referencing all four Golden Girls in four consecutive weeks.
Yeah, but I'm going to pull the curtain back a little bit for our fans here, and that we actually haven't recorded in like 3 weeks because we recorded two shows. Or I haven't, and then I was gone right. And all that. So I really do feel out of practice and really needing my Mad Chatters Disney fix. So.
Thanks for showing the magic to everyone.
Sorry.
Yes, it's ruined.
Gird your magical loins. I showed it.
Well, what'd you do on your time off? Did any of you go to the parks at all?
No.
No.
Sadly not. No, I texted Matt about going on Monday this week, but he was unable to go.
I was in North Carolina for my cousin's wedding.
Oh. What's the commute there? It's just a few hours.
In North Carolina? Oh.
You can go to Carowinds.
Oh.
No, I was gone for 2 weeks, mostly doing work-related things, but I did get to swing by and see our newest Madge Hatter fan. And I'm not a baby person, but he's adorable and perfect in every way. So there you go.
You're supposed to say that. You're his uncle.
No, I know I'm supposed to say it, but I genuinely mean it. I got
him. And you hate children, so.
Yeah, he's like this child and your child, Matt, are the only ones I really care about. So there you go.
Everybody loves my child.
Well, it is August, so even though you haven't gone to the parks, I'm sure if you go soon, you're about to start seeing Halloween directions. Halloween decorations.
How to do Halloween.
Step one. No. Anyway, Halloween decorations, I'm sure they're going up any day now. I saw that reservations are already open for food and wine stuff, so it's almost that time of year. Hard to believe.
That's a good sign, though, because that means here in Florida, the weather's going to get a little cooler. Mm-hmm. The crowds are going to get a little thinner. So we look forward
to more sparse.
Yeah.
The food and wine festival around the corner. There's no crowds getting any thinner.
That is true. On the weekends, particularly. But
I mean, girth.
Fat jokes. Take that, America.
Sorry.
These weeks off, I lost my
I was getting myself so flabbergasted the other day thinking about Flower and Food and Wine Festival, and I remembered that we had gone and gotten that bubble tea and the barbecue and the stuff, and I was like, was that really a year ago? But that was Flower and Garden Festival, which is now
food and
wine number two with flowers.
That's what I think they're thinking of changing the name to that. Food and wine, too, with flowers and some gardens.
There's some plants with something.
Yeah. That's really what it is. Yeah, you're right. That really did make me feel like time had flown by, but you're right. That was just in spring. So. Yeah,
you're not that old yet. Before we kick off the show, I do want to remind our listeners that we are selling Mad Chatters t-shirts in purple and navy, and we'll only be selling those until the 17th, and after that, they will be gone. So get your orders in to gear@madchatters.net. Let us know your name and size, and we will get back to you with more information. Or, of course, if you know us personally, you can just contact one of us as well, and we'll be happy to put you on the list.
Let me just say two things. First off, you're going to want to get one of these t-shirts because this is first edition. Mm. So, you know, like anything first edition, down the road, it's going to be worth something.
Well, you never know. You never know where we will be in 20 years.
That is true.
Why not spend $18? I mean, it's just $18.
Yeah, a small investment. You spend more on that at Starbucks if you have a family.
I was like, what are you buying at Starbucks?
For just 5 drinks at Starbucks.
I mean, if you get a drink and your John Legend CD.
And like a DVD.
And there you go. Second thing.
Sarah McLachlan.
I need you to, if you are a fan of the color purple, I need the actual color, not the Alice Walker book or movie. I need you to buy the purple shirt because
I tried all my life.
I am a foreigner in a strange land here with my love of purple. And so I really need people to step up and buy the purple shirt to show my fellow host here that people like purple.
Okay, so, let's just be real. We did 2 colors because one of them no, this isn't right. Once we found out we could do 2 colors, then it was okay for Jeremy's purple to get thrown into the mix. Of all the orders I've received, 0 are purple, except for the
true
one Jeremy ordered.
I was going to say, I ordered a purple one.
Not that I don't like them. Where the majority is going.
I know. I just feel bad because I really wanted to stick it in your all's face and be like, haha, see, people like purple. But I think the purple shirt looks great. So that one's really going to be collectible down the road.
Oh, that's true.
Because not a lot of people are getting it. It's going to be worse. So
that's exactly what makes something collectible.
I might get one of each. We'll see. We'll see.
There you go. That's what I'm doing. I'm buying one of each.
Because it wasn't valuable. It wasn't valuable at any time ever. That's when something becomes collectible.
We should also mention that children's sizes are available as well.
If you sure, have, yes.
Because we've had a couple of people ask about that. So Christmas is coming, folks. Stock up now. Nothing says I love you, happy birthday, Jesus, quite like a Mad Hatter's t-shirt.
Mm. 7-year-olds love our show. Is that why we're doing the children's sizes?
Yeah.
We're a big hit with the kiddos. Anyway, gear@madchatters.net. Let us know. Okay, all right, let's go ahead and get started by doing some eating around the world. Now, Matt, you went somewhere recently that you want to talk about, and I have never been to this place, and Jeremy, I don't think you have either now?
Nope.
Okay, so tell us about it.
A few months ago, my wife and I had the opportunity to meet some friends at Trattoria Al Forno, which is at Disney's Boardwalk Resort, out actually on the boardwalk. This is the restaurant. I think it opened almost a year ago. This took the place of Cucina by Cat Cora, which I never visited.
That's right.
But had terrible reviews. I guess it was like Greek-inspired dishes, but nobody ever had anything good to say about it except for the breakfast. But either way, I never had either one. So Trattoria Al Forno, as you can tell, is an Italian place, Italian eatery, Italian restaurant that took the place of that restaurant. And as I said, we were meeting some friends there. We rolled in, and very much like a lot of Disney table service restaurants, and I know I sound like a broken record on this, it just lacks a certain elegance that you would expect to get from a table service restaurant. Like, you're going to go in and sit down and have a meal. It feels like a quick service restaurant that you go in and sit down and have a waiter at. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's what I should come to expect now from table service. Maybe I'm looking for signature dining. Maybe that's what I need to do. But it just feels like that, you know, very bare tables, no tablecloths and no coverings whatsoever, paper napkins, just things that just, you know, they come across as hurried. And there is that atmosphere in a lot of the Disney restaurants now with so many reservations filling up. There was a very hurried atmosphere here. Not only is sitting down, but the bread was already there at the table. The bread was great, though. It was like, you know, Italian-style loaf, and then they had the olive oil balsamic parmesan dip you could dip it in. That was A+. Everything was very hurried, and maybe there are people that enjoy that. I'm not really into that. If I'm sitting down to enjoy a meal, I'm not into, you know, be in and out in 30 minutes.
Unless I specifically tell the waiter that, then no.
Yeah,
I don't like that,
right.
You know.
Yep. And, I mean, there are instances in which you do. But if you're in a hurry, you don't go to a place like that.
So, yeah, that's true.
I expect a little longer time. We ate. Well, there were four of us there. We all got three different things, and I tried the three different things between the four of us.
I assume you asked permission first.
No, I waited until I went to the restroom.
A stab de ravioli, and it's good.
I ordered the chicken parmigiana. I was just feeling traditional.
Yeah.
I was between like the spaghetti and meatballs and the chicken parmigiana, so I ordered the chicken parmigiana, and it was a nice, big, like thin cutlet of chicken, like it should be, not like a thick, you know, breast. It was that thin sliced, breaded. It didn't come with spaghetti. It came with fettuccine with bolognese sauce. So like a thicker noodles with the meat sauce.
Snickerdoodles.
Thinner noodles. thicker noodles. There you go. Thicker noodles with meat sauce. And it was good. I've had better from like Maggiano's, you know, your neighborhood Italian eatery. The flavor was kind of in between. It didn't taste like much. You know, it was a tomato, chicken. You know, there wasn't anything like, you know, when you're outside and it smells like pizza and the brick oven and garlic and like, Italian food, you didn't get that smack in the right side of your mouth that said you're eating garlicky Italian food. It was just kind of like, And maybe that's my fault for ordering chicken parmesan.
I was going to say, you did order one of the most basic items on the menu.
Yeah, so it was all right.
What were the more elaborate menu items?
There really wasn't any.
I'd be glad to share some. I have the menu pulled up.
Please.
Yeah, I'm sure there were some steak dishes on there and things. Go ahead.
Baked lasagna, braised beef. It looks like bologna, but I know that's not it.
Bolognese.
Yeah.
Yes. Broccoli rabe.
Broccoli rabe.
Campanella. I don't know what that is. Green beans, roasted potatoes, and some kind of pesto. Chicken breast a la Parmenia.
Are you sure you want to read this menu?
Yeah.
Any veal?
There's veal. There's a pork chop. There's roasted portobello mushrooms. There's something else I can't say as well. Lamb shank.
Yes, thank you.
T-bone steak Florentine is probably...
Now there is where it's at.
That's the most expensive.
Now, I was going to make a note about the menu. As you're reading that, I'm reminded, obviously, that this is not an intimidating Italian restaurant.
Right.
This is not a adventurous, super exotic, authentic Italian. It's a very safe, obviously, like spaghetti, fettuccine.
It really sounds like it's on par with like a Maggiano's kind of a feel.
Yeah.
Or very macaroni country, grill.
Rustic Italian, I guess the way you would say it. Not, you know, refined Italian or whatever. My wife just got a pizza. She likes, you know, homemade pizzas. And it was authentic Neapolitan-style Italian pizza like you would expect from Via Napoli or whatever. Very flat, thin crust, cracker-like, you know, charred on the bottom. I think hers had, like, prosciutto and pepperoni on it. And it was good. I mean, but it was just a, you know, like a Via Napoli style pizza. It wasn't like, oh, this is the best pizza I ever had.
It's hard to mess up authentic pizza.
Yeah.
Well, at those kind of places.
It had that really, if you like that, some people don't like that charred, real Italian pizza taste for the crust. You know how it gets kind of black on the bottom that it's supposed to? Mm-hmm. Some people don't like that. So if you don't like that kind of crust, it's not like pan style Pizza Hut pizza.
Yeah, no, I grew up in St. Louis, so I like the thicker, I mean, not the thicker, the crunchier crust.
Okay.
Throwing that out there.
Is that something St. Louis offers?
Yeah, St. Louis is known for having very thin crust, you know, almost like a cracker, and very crispy.
I thought it might be one of those things for people, you know, I'm from the South, so I like pecans.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway.
Well, listen, I lived 2 hours from St. Louis growing up, and I did not know that about St. Louis pizza, so there you go.
You never had, like, Emo's pizza?
I've had it, but...
That's St. Louis style. That
Emo pizza, it makes you sad and happy at the same time.
Not yeah. Emo, but Emo's. I-M-O. Not
oh,
Emo.
I see.
You're a what? Never mind.
My wife got the pizza. The two other people we were with both ordered the same thing. I think you read it. It was like a pasta that had a basil. Good grief! Why is the word a basil pesto sauce on it? And I love pesto, and that would hit you in the side of the mouth with that garlic. So maybe I wanted that, and I should have gotten it. In fact, I think I remember. Yeah, that was it. Yeah, but it had potatoes and stuff in it. And if you don't know what a pesto is, it's a basil leaves and garlic and nuts, and then you put it with oil, and it's just super duper good and really green. They added chicken to it, and it was really good. And I should have ordered that. And I think it came with little bow tie pastas, if I'm not incorrect. But it was really good. We didn't try dessert. If you are an Italian fan and you like your Olive Garden, your Maggiano's, your Carrabba's, or whatever else there is in this world you can eat Italian at, it's fine. But if you're like Italian it up one night, you might want to go to Il Molino at the Swan or the Dolphin.
Yeah.
It's got really, really good reviews. Now, that might be a tad on the intimidating fine dining side of things, if that bothers you. But if you're just up for an Italian meal that's 6 out of 10, comfortable, you're at the boardwalk, you want somewhere to eat, probably not going to be a long wait. You could probably walk in.
Okay, I was just about to ask, what was the crowd like there? Because they already shut down Cucina's because no one was going. So is this next on the chopping list?
I don't think so. It wasn't like empty, but it seems like the kind of place you could walk up to and get a place because it's big, for one thing.
The decor looks nice. I like the inside. It doesn't scream Italian to me, but...
Well, did Disney World really need another Italian restaurant? Because you think you've got Tony's in Main Street, on Main Street.
You got two restaurants in Italy right there by the boardwalk.
You've got Mama Melrose's in Hollywood Studios.
Yeah, it might have been a bit superfluous, but...
I think it comes down to people like Italian food, for one, or at least Americanized Italian food.
Like Matt said, it's safe.
And Boardwalk is going to be one of those places that people who aren't necessarily even going to the parks are going to be. So they want something like that that's right there.
And looking at this menu, even though every dish is maybe a couple of dollars higher than you would pay at Olive Garden, it's still a decent price.
Decent priced, yes.
Okay.
For such a... You can
easily split a pizza and a salad and be, under $30 probably.
Yeah, most of the dishes here, I'm looking at most of them, are between $17 and $22. Yep. So for Walt Disney World, that's pretty...
That's very
cheap.
Reasonable. Yeah.
Cool. We just really sold this place, didn't we? Decent Italian food at a low price.
If I'm ever craving Italian at Disney World, it will probably be the first restaurant that comes to mind, considering Mama Melrose's is off my list forever after I went last time.
Yeah.
But
I just don't go for... I wouldn't go for Italian. If you're going to go for Italian, go for the Via Napoli and get the pizza. That's the recommendation.
You're going to get a lot more pizza options there and a lot more... Not necessarily exotic, but different combinations, like your prosciutto and melon pizza and things like that.
That's good. I am not a sweet things on my pizza kind of a person, but I tried that melon prosciutto, and that was good.
Mm-hmm. Well, there you go. So our review of Trattoria Al Forno is go to Via Napoli. Great.
Time for another Matchhitter game! And now here's your Matchhitter host, Matchhitter Derek!
Thank you, Steve.
Do you have something stuck in your throat?
Shut up. That's the audience.
Oh, my bad. Steve had something stuck in his throat.
I'm not yelling, I just smoke a lot.
Well, thank you, Steve, for that wonderful introduction. I am going to host a game tonight between our Mad Chatters, Matt and Jeremy, pitting the two champions who always defeat me against one another. So today's game is called What's in a Name? And today I'm going to see how well you know the official titles of Disney World attractions, restaurants, and merchandise locations. I will be asking a series of 50-50 questions, and you need to tell me if the correct answer is A, or 1, or B, or 2, depending on what you have in front of you to
use. They correspond.
Yes, yes. So to recap, 1 and A are the same thing.
I am a little nervous about this game because I am horrible with names in general. I'm a little
Matt,
nervous here.
You already got a step ahead. Or are you saying this so that way when you win, you can be like, wow, I'm just that awesome?
No, I am genuinely concerned.
All right. The first question. Which of these shows is subtitled Epic Stunt Spectacular? A, Indiana Jones, or B, Lights, Motors, Action? Which is subtitled Epic Stunt Spectacular? Answers.
Show you your answer. I said A.
And Matt did as well, and that is correct. It's the Indiana Jones Epic Stunt Spectacular. Next question. What is the name of the small food and merchandise location that sells coffee and books in Disney's Hollywood Studios, tucked behind Sci-Fi Dine-In Theater? Is it A, the Writer's Shop, or B, the Writer's Stop? A, the Writer's Shop. B, the Writer's Stop. Answers.
I know it's named after Ellen's sitcom.
That's right. I forgot that.
But I can't remember exactly, so I'm just going
to
guess.
And weren't you, like, married to Ellen?
Yeah, I was going to guess B.
That is correct. You are both correct. It is B, the Writer's Stop. And who was married to Ellen?
Me. Matt, by the way, it's... Yeah, I don't want to talk about it. It was the 90s. We just lost Princess Diana. It was a hard time.
She was obviously confused.
As was I. So, and Matt, by the way, it's an audio podcast, so it helps the listeners if you say your answer out loud.
I'm sorry. I thought Eric would do it since he's the host.
That is true, but he's
I have to do everything. I hate these games.
But you made us bring materials.
You're right. Next question. What is the name of the merchandise location in Storybook Circus? Big Top Souvenirs, or B, Big Top Gifts? A, Big Top Souvenirs. B, Big Top Gifts. Answers, please.
I said A.
A.
That is correct. It is Big Top Souvenirs. The score is 3-3.
Okay,
next question.
Now.
Okay, good. What is the name of the restaurant in the Norway Pavilion? Pronunciations aside, the name of the restaurant, is it Akershus Royal Banquet Hall, or B, Akershus Princess Storybook Hall? A or B? Answers, please.
I said A.
A.
That is correct. Royal Banquet Hall, Akershus. Akershus. Yeah. Akershus.
Akershus.
What is the name of the apparel store in Adventureland that's now a Sunglass Hut? Is it Island Supply by Sunglass Hut, or Island Mercantile by Sunglass Hut? A, Island Supply. B, Island Mercantile. Answers, please.
I said B.
A.
The correct answer is A, Island Supply. Island Mercantile is actually in Animal Kingdom.
Ooh. Formal protest.
Sorry.
Oh, I don't know. Okay. All right.
I mean, you can protest if you want, but it's not going to get you anywhere. Okay. Next question. Which of these food locations has the word restaurant in its actual name on the sign? Beer Garden Restaurant, or Pinocchio Village House Restaurant? Which actually has restaurant in its name?
According to what again? The sign?
The sign. A, Beer Garden. B, Pinocchio Village House.
According
to everything. According to the sign, according to the website, its actual name.
Yeah.
I said B.
I said B as well.
The correct answer is A. It is the Beer Garden Restaurant. That surprised me. I did not realize that.
Yeah.
But. All right. No one gets that one. Next question. Which of these restaurants has the word steakhouse in its title? Artist Point, or B, Le Cellier, which has steakhouse in its title? Answers, please.
I said B.
B.
You both said B, and you both are correct. Le Cellier Steakhouse. Very good. What is the name of the Phineas and Ferb interactive game in Epcot? Is it A, Agent P's World Showcase Challenge, or B, Agent P's World Showcase Adventure? Is it the World Showcase Challenge or the World Showcase Adventure?
Answers, the correct answer is please. C. It's the World Showcase Crap Fest. But anyways.
It's the World Showcase. I don't know because we didn't get 5 minutes into it.
I said B.
I said B as well.
You both are correct. It is the World Showcase Adventure. Look at you guys knowing you're Phineas and Ferb.
Because it's not very challenging.
Well, it was challenging to get through it, but not in the way that they probably mean. Next question. What is the name of the character buffet in Contemporary Resort? Is it Chef Mickey or Chef Mickey's?
Now we're getting ridiculous.
Is that A or B respectively?
Ridiculous is not the right word. We're getting nitpicky. A, Chef Mickey. B, Chef Mickey's.
I said B, apostrophe S.
I did too.
Oh, you're both right. See, there's no need to complain.
Well, I think I checked that recently on one of our podcasts because I kept saying Chef Mickey. I was like, is it Chef Mickey?
See, so, I feel like if we host a podcast, we should be particular with our wording, and that's why this quiz is very helpful.
We should be. That's why I looked it up.
This quiz is informative as well as fun, as all games should be.
Yes.
Said Ross Geller. Okay. What is the official subtitle of Star Tours? We answered this a few weeks back. We're going to see if you remember. The official subtitle, is it The Adventures Continue or B, The Adventure Continues?
Oh, I feel like I'm back in English class. Underline the noun.
Is there a comma after? Okay, The Adventures Continue, A, or B, The Adventure Continues?
I'm going to go with A.
I'm going to go with B. Ooh, whatever letter that is.
The correct answer is A, The Adventures Continue.
That makes sense because you have more adventures in this
version. Yeah, true. I thought that, but then I thought that's why it seemed odd to me that they named it the other.
The score is now tied.
My brain.
8-8, and that brings us to the final set of questions, which is going to be a bit different. I'm going to take turns asking you a question, and the other person will get a chance to steal if you don't get it right. Since there's an even number of questions, I will start with Jeremy, just because he's on my left.
Oh, okay.
For this round, you need to fill in the blank. What is the name of the Little Mermaid attraction in Magic Kingdom?
Oh, gosh.
Under the Sea, blank of the Little Mermaid.
I always get this confused with the California one. I'm going to say Journey.
That is correct. It is Journey. Voyage is in Hollywood Studios.
Yes.
And I believe DCA is called Ariel's Undersea Adventure.
Yeah, I get them all confused.
Okay. Matt, your question. What is Expedition Everest's official subtitle? Legend of the Blank Mountain.
Forbidden.
Okay, good job. I felt like that was the first time I'd ever heard that, so to me that was kind of hard, but... Never mind. Okay, Jeremy, fill in the blank for this Tomorrowland quick service location. Oh. Cosmic Rays Blank Cafe.
Oh, son of a gun. Cosmic Rays. Say it again.
Blank Cafe.
Cosmic Rays.
Yogurt?
Yogurt Cafe.
Oh, Cosmic my. Rays. Burger Cafe.
No, I'm sorry. That's not right. Matt, do you want to steal?
Hate this game.
Cosmic Rays Starlight Cafe.
That is correct. Ah! Matt, we go back to you for the next question. What is the subtitle of Boma, the restaurant in Animal Kingdom Lodge? Blank of Africa. Boma, blank of Africa. It's plural, so blanks of Africa.
Mm. I'm going to say flavors.
Yes, very good. Flavors.
We also would have accepted
Africa. Of Africa.
I was thinking tastes. Tastes?
Oh, see, I at first I had it as a 50-50, either flavors or tastes.
I was going to say tastes, so that would have.
This tastes of Africa. Okay.
Well, not
Jeremy, what is the only...
Not offend all of our African listeners.
We're getting to the end. Jeremy, what is the only attraction to have its sponsor in the official title. So it's the name of the attraction, and then it says presented by, and then it has its sponsor.
Oh, gosh. Can you tell me what park it's in?
In the park, Epcot is an attraction that says the attraction presented by blank.
The only thing I can think of is Spaceship Earth, presented by Siemens.
That is incorrect.
Ah!
Ooh, that's what I thought.
Uh-oh.
Okay, so it's an attraction that's got the name that's in the actual title.
Yes. It's got its sponsor in its actual title.
Is it, geez, I can only think of the one.
Now, Jeremy, are you sad that you asked me to narrow it down to the park?
Just
no,
Epcot?
I still can't think of it, so.
I'll give you 4 more seconds.
Journey to Imagination presented by Kodak.
No, it's Test Track presented by Chevrolet.
Oh, I thought about that, but I was like, no, that's not it.
Which makes sense, because the whole queue is just like Chevy cars that were never made or that might one day be made. Who knows? Okay, Matthew, your question.
They say something about presented by Siemens somewhere.
Yeah. I know they used to like project it on giant letters on Spaceship Earth as you walked out from Illuminations, but... All right, Matt. 2 Disney resorts have the words resort and spa in their title. The first is Grand Floridian Resort and Spa. What is the second? Disney's blank blank resort and spa. Now I'm afraid I made these way too hard.
I think I know it.
It's like the Animal Kingdom challenge all over again.
Saratoga Springs.
Very good.
Oh, you got very nice. It.
Saratoga Springs Resort
and Spa. That was
going to
be my guess.
All right,
no,
Jeremy.
It wasn't.
Not counting the villas and then Swan and Dolphin, every Disney resort has either resort or lodge in its title. Except one. One Disney resort is referred to as an inn, I-N-N. Which resort is it?
The answer is the Boardwalk. In.
Thank you, Google, on Jeremy's phone.
I did not Google, I swear.
Because you were looking at me, and I'm like, what's he looking at down there?
I promise, the phone is right here. Nothing.
All right, that is correct. Yeah. Which is funny, because earlier in the show, Matt referred to it as Boardwalk Resort, and I was hoping Jeremy wouldn't correct him and then give it away, but okay.
There's no room there.
That's true. There's never room there, so you're going to have to stay in the stable Outback. Final question. Yes. Final question goes to Matt, who unfortunately is ahead by 2. So it's impossible for Jeremy to come back. But I will go ahead and ask it anyway. Name
one. If I steal
one,
it, though, it's for 10, right?
Something like that. Name one of the 2 attractions at Walt Disney World with the word starring in its name. So it says the name of the attraction starring blank. There are 2 of them. I want you to name one.
Oh, just one, right? Rock and Roller Coaster starring Aerosmith.
Yeah, that's it.
Can I try for the other one?
Yeah.
Is it O Canada?
No. It is Grand Fiesta Tour starring the 3 Caballeros.
Starring Donald Duck?
The 3 Caballeros.
Oh, yeah.
Those 3 Caballeros.
Yeah. Which means our final score is Matt 13, Jeremy 10. Our new victor is Mad Chatter Matt.
It's not so new.
You've enjoyed another Mad Chatter game. Join us next time. Same Mad Chatter time. Same Mad Chatter podcast.
Sound like you said buttcast.
On this week's show, we're going to get back into our series on animated films and their presence in the parks. We have already discussed everything from Snow White to whatever closed out the 70s. Help me out.
The Rescuers.
There you go. The Rescuers. Which brings us to the 1980s.
Which is why you're wearing your leg warmers and members only jacket.
Exactly. Thank you for telling our audience that. All the 80s. What an interesting decade for Disney films. Now, Jeremy, you're our resident historian. So I want to know, what's the first thing that comes to mind when you think of the 80s Disney animated films?
Ronald Reagan.
Not where I expected you to go with that.
Tear down this wall.
No, of course, my first thought is... Well, I don't want to say my first thought. Should I say my first thought? I'm so sorry. I'm confused. Do you want me to say the first
thought,
film?
Listen, my first thought. We're not talking about just animated films. Just first Disney thought about the 80s, right?
Whatever you want to say in response to my question, I don't care. Just somebody say something.
Oh my gosh. Have we reached that point already? Did you want me to kick off into the first film is what I'm trying to get you to say.
No.
Okay.
No. I just mean when you think of the 80s as a whole, because I feel like these movies all kind of have similar things going for them. What words would you use to describe these films in general?
Oh.
When I think about these films from the 80s, I think about a difficult time for animation in the Disney company. I feel like it was a time where they kind of lost their identity, as I think we'll see as we discuss these. But I think all that adversity, as we will see, leads to a new awakening.
Ooh. You teased that just perfectly.
Little teaser right there.
Mm. See, because my first word is dark.
That as well. Yes.
I mean, I'll go ahead and name some of the films. We'll get to these. But like the first one is about two animals that want to be friends but can never be friends. Mm. One of them has like some scary skeleton king as the villain. Yeah. One starts with like a kidnapping of a little girl's father. Like these are just dark films. Even the animation itself is very just dark.
Well, you have to think too, the 1980s was a strange time, and I love the 80s. If I could go back and live in a decade, I would probably pick the 80s. Well, maybe the 1920s, then the 80s. But anyways,
I would pick the 320s.
Wow, very specific.
Very specific. But he wants to be on the council of Trent.
Nicaea.
I get my councils confused.
Trent was 1500s.
A little theology jokes for y'all there. Anyways.
Okay, I'm awake now. Let's get back to the podcast.
Look at the children's films that were being produced in the 1980s. I mean, you had things that – it was just dark all around, like Labyrinth and Dark Crystal from the Jim Henson Company. And then even Disney was putting out like Something Wicked This Way Comes, mm-hmm. and that Return of the Oz, which is like the freakiest children's film that's ever been produced. So it was a strange time in children's fantasy, sci-fi kind of feel. But
I'm just looking through the list of Disney films here. And, you know, everyone loved the movie Benji, the little dog, it's lost and finds its way home. I look at the one that there's a sequel that comes out in the 80s that happens to be called Benji, the Hunted.
But then you had films like Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, which came out in the 80s. Uh-huh. And you have, you know, some up good feeling films like Splash came out. That's not necessarily geared for kids, but still, you know, nice upbeat films. But for whatever reason, the sort of fantasy animation of the 80s, even like Fievel Goes West. I mean,
Michelle Pfeiffer Goes West. What?
The first one. And then both of the Fievel movies were really kind of dark and depressing as well. Like,
plus, this was the decade that brought us Magic Journeys. So,
lest we forget,
it's whatever was happening to people's brains in the 60s and 70s was just kind of starting to fizzle out into real life. So we had this horrifying, nightmarish landscape between an absolute acid trip and reality that we do not get to until the 90s. So the 80s are just kind of this no man's nightmarish middle ground.
Let that be a lesson. Actions have consequences.
Yes. The 1980s.
All right. Well, let's get into the first acid trip of a film, I guess, which is The Fox and the Hound. Maybe not so much. Okay, but this was 1981. The Fox and the Hound. Jeremy, go.
First off, let me say, growing up, loved this movie.
Really?
It's still like my third favorite, even though it's so blasted sad.
It is so sad.
This is the Bambi for our generation. It really is.
I was going to say the exact same thing.
Yes.
I find more lightheartedness in Bambi.
Oh, well, the scene, and I recently watched it again, and the scene where the old woman, I forget her name, Tweed or something like that, and she takes Todd out in her car and sings the song as she lets him go, and he has that look where he doesn't know what's going on, and then she leaves him and drives away. Rip my heart out. I mean, just like rip it out and stomp it on the ground. Very sad film, but it did spawn a sequel, a straight to DVD sequel, so there you go.
Yeah, but I feel like every movie from this time on spawns some sort of sequel.
That is true, but this is the only one with voice by Reba McEntire.
Oh, I see. That's why I love it.
There you go.
This movie is so sad. I do think the animation is really beautiful in this film. I like it a lot. But the film itself, I also watched it recently. I don't know. It just gave me bad feelings. I just wanted to like take it out and throw it away and not watch it again.
Those are not feelings that... it's odd. It's odd because...
No, it's Todd.
Waka. Things change and how to say this, developmental periods and the way people, I don't know, grow and evolve and change and learn and all that, that grows. And so there was a certain level of reality people could take in the 50s, 60s, 70s, obviously in the 80s, that kids today, I don't think, I'm like, even I, growing up in the 90s watching this, it was just too much. It's too much to deal with. There's some real, like, complicated ethical and socio-economical issues.
Film, on a deeper level, you could write a dissertation with the themes because it's the whole nature versus nurture. Then it's also, you know, do you judge people by who they are or what they look like or da-da-da, you know, all that kind of a thing. But it does have great music because, like I said, that song she sings – is very tender. And then one of my favorite Disney songs, Best of Friends, is from this film, which is
just that's the thing. As I was watching recently, I realized they're really not best friends for that long in the movie at all. Like, they sing that song the first time they meet and they're like, "You're my best friend," and then like the next day Copper's already leaving.
That's why you got to see part two, because part two is kind of like a midway when they're kids, they have an adventure still.
Okay.
I'm just kidding. Don't watch the second one. It's horrible. But anyways, this is an interesting time in the Disney company again, because this film is you have the nine old men and they're getting older and starting to retire. And this is a project that they're working on. And then you have this next crop of animators who are coming in, who are eventually going to lead into the Disney Renaissance. But this film struggled in production because you had sort of this battle of old hat versus new hat going at it kind of a thing. So,
and I also wondered, as I thought about this, not only because these films are very interesting and different from what Disney is used to doing, but also because the next film isn't released for another 4 years, I wonder if the development of Epcot, I don't know how, but I wonder if it's somehow like distracted from all these things going on. I don't know.
Animation, as you can see throughout the 70s and into the 80s, the animation aspect of the company was definitely going downhill, and it was definitely because of parks and live action and other things, you know, and so animation kind of got viewed as like, oh, that's something we used to do, that's an old thing, you know, and we put out an animated film because we're supposed to, and as we'll see after we talk about the next film, how that really caused animation to suffer.
Well, before we move on to the next film, what references in Disney World can you think of for Fox and Hound? I got nothing.
Well, I read in the early 90s there was an interactive ride in Fantasyland in which
you get a shotgun.
Riders had a shotgun and you shot the animatronic foxes and there's 3D blood effects. No.
Oh, gosh.
That was not there. That was not present. I can't think of any unless there's like an obscure reference to in merchandise something somewhere.
I can't even think of anything like that. Yeah.
No, I can't think of anything either. But again, I would like to see that song. If nothing else, the song Best of Friends needs to come out in some parade or something.
Yeah, that's Fantasmic, something. Yeah. Like even those bubbles in Fantasmic, which has every Disney movie, doesn't have a lot of the ones we're about to talk about. So, all right. Well, then let's move on to The Black Cauldron. 1985. This was Disney's 25th animated film. I recently watched it for the very first time.
And it just turned 30, like, last week.
That's true, it did. And Disney actually acknowledged it on its on its Twitter,
which is a rare thing.
It released a GIF online of like the smoke coming out of the cauldron and then the whatever that king's name is, the Horned King.
Well, I think there's starting to be enough of a cult following behind this film that Disney can accept it. The film's based on books by Lloyd Alexander, The Chronicles of
Prydain.
I can never say that right. They actually got the rights in the early 70s.
Well, the books were only written in the mid 60s.
Yeah, so they got.
Let me tell you, I went to town on this movie because it just kept going back. This one's based on the things you just mentioned, The Chronicles of Prydain by Lloyd Alexander. They're based on pre-Christian Welsh mythology. They're based on, like, it just keeps going back and back and back and back. And it's all just very interesting to me. But that's neither here nor there to the park. So we'll keep the history lesson to another day.
Well, it's just interesting. This film took, when it finally started production in, like, 1980, it just drug on. And it rewrites and script changes and da-da-da-da. And Jeffrey Katzenberg, who came on board with the Disney company. If you watch Waking Sleeping Beauty, the documentary, that's everybody's homework who's listening. Watch Waking Sleeping Beauty. That really explains this period well. But it was just a disaster of a film, and they did their best to kind of cut and paste it together. And I don't think it's ever made back the money that was spent on it. But there was a couple unique things about it. First thing is that it's the first Disney animated film to be rated PG. And in fact, there was one time it was almost rated PG-13 because of some of the violence they had to cut from it. Which I don't think we've had an animated film rated PG-13 yet. So
not
that would have been
now.
Interesting and very controversial for the 80s. Yeah. But it's also the first time that you have computers used to assist animation as well. So
I was going to say, you get to something like this, and first of all, I love The Black Cauldron.
See, I like it as well.
I love that it's dark. It's one of my favorite villains because he lacks no empathy whatsoever. It's not even like Maleficent. You know, she's a woman and she's got needs. I'm just saying. That sounded like that's where it was going.
Her and Frollo, they'd be meeting those needs.
Yeah. No, this guy, I mean, he's just like a skeleton with, you know, glowing eyes. And there's no empathy, no personality. He's just frightening. So I like the whole dark. It does capture that medieval... I guess Welsh, and not just Welsh, just medieval. Think about European mythology. It just captures that whole feel. And the music, the soundtrack is very synthesized, and it might be the first animated film from Disney. Fox and the Hound probably, you know, used traditional kind of scores and stuff. This had a very synthesized feel to it.
But also, this film does feature some big names in voice cast. John Hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And also it has John Huston is the narrator in it, who is Angelica Huston's father, which I thought was really interesting because, again, this is still in a day and age before big Hollywood stars were doing voice casting and voice roles because that was viewed still as below them. You know, so to have those voices of recognizable names in there is a pretty big deal.
Yeah, Slate Magazine posted something recently on this movie and called it the film that almost killed Disney animation. Yes. And it was talking about, like you said, how there was a shift and how he said 13 animators quit in 79 as while this film, the production kept getting delayed. And it was talking about how Katzenberg came in and was trying to make smaller budgets on all these films. And so it just caused a lot of problems because they were trying to hastily rewrite scenes and reanimate entire scenes, and they didn't have that long. And
well, that's the thing. And Katzenberg came in, and he didn't understand the animation business, so he was like, "Well, you need to cut that and need it." And they were like, "You don't just cut things out of an animated film. Like, you can't just go refilm something so easily." So,
right.
After this movie flopped, it was beaten by the Care Bears movie in 1985 at the box office. animation was kicked out. Of their
reputatory
studio, which is, you know, the studio that Walt himself built for animation, and they were sent to trailers on an adjacent lot, you know, in another town kind of a thing, and animation was on life support at this point because
you have to. There's a thing that we have to remember that obviously they couldn't have known at that time because they're a business and they're trying to make money, and you know there's success and there's failure and there's consequences for failure and people have to be fired and all that. Because I understand that. Looking back on it though, we have the privilege of seeing that sometimes this is just words of wisdom. Sometimes before something can just reach its fullest potential, you really do just have to jack it up. I mean, you got to reach bottom of the barrel before you start climbing out. You got to come to the valley before you start getting up on the mountain.
Preach.
And that's what happens here.
Are you talking about this movie and they finally had something good because of all the problems, or are you talking about the movies of the 80s in general?
No, this movie.
Oh.
Now, look, I like it. And I there's cult following, you know, but as far as success on a wide scale goes, they, like Jeremy said, had lost direction, lost identity. There's the difference between the classic animators and their storytelling evolving into the new animators and their style of storytelling. And they're just a lot of stuff that's lost. And sometimes you just have to completely lose your way. And this sounds so inspirational. I mean it in a very real sense. I'm not trying to be like Oprah here. You gotta get lost in order to be found. There's just no way to say it without sounding like
come
that.
On, I'm gonna run the aisles. When they acquired the rights to it in 71, the ones who really pushed to get it was Ollie Johnston and Frank Thomas, who are very well known animators. And they said this movie, if done right, will be up there with Snow White, but if done wrong, it will be a disaster. And so, you know, I think that kind of
I should qualify my liking through. Of it. My liking of it certainly does not put it on par with the Disney classics. Or I like it the same way I would like something like The Dark Crystal or Labyrinth or any of those kind of 80s fantasy. It feels like an 80s fantasy just animated.
Yeah, it fits right in with those, and that's why I like them, because they're fun characters. It's a fun universe, you know, that they're set in. That's what I like about it.
I don't know if fun is the right word, because it's really kind of creepy.
Creepy, but fun in a creepy way.
But when I watched it was better.
That's how I'm described on my Tinder profile, actually.
but creepy.
Fun in the creepy way. It was better than I expected it to be. I will say that when I watched it. I didn't quite understand all the hate for it. But I don't know if it's so much hate as just, man, it flopped so bad when it came out. Mm-hmm. But let's go ahead and get to references of the parks. I think this is yet another film from the 80s that has no references today. That we know.
Well, wait. Black Cauldron, there are references in the. Well, there were references in the park.
Right, that's why I said today.
Today.
See, that's different from the past, which we'll get to in a second. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, though. Is there anything today that you can think of?
No, nope. But okay. I was.
At Tokyo Disney, they have that thing.
What?
No, that ended in 2006, I saw.
They don't do that no more?
No.
What was it?
The Horned King was one of the villains in their.
They had a mystery walkthrough tour of Cinderella Castle that ended with a big special effects show in which the Horned King manifested himself.
That's funny because I could totally see one of those Asian cultures really embracing something like this. Like
they
the
did.
Darker...
That's exactly what happened. But you know, Tokyo Disney was open in 81.
What do you mean by those Asian cultures?
The Asian cultures of the world.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
You know the ones I'm talking about. I'm just saying, like, there are certain genres that they really latch onto, and I could totally see that being one of their favorites.
Mm-hmm.
But now, one of the things that used to be there is something we've talked about. Gurgies do the voice. Gurgies, Munchies, and Crunchies.
Gurgie. No, I can't even do it. Gurgies, Munchies,
oh,
and
yeah,
crunches.
That's right. Gurgie.
Gurgie.
Gurgie, Munchies, and Crunchies.
No, Yoda, that's different.
That was like Yoda.
Anyway, that was like... I am. Did you guys see the blog post that the guy posted who used to work there?
No.
Okay, so I looked up Gurgies, Munchies, and Crunchies, and then a former cast member posted this whole thing about how he worked there when it opened. It was like a walk-up window with really basic snacks in Fantasyland. And he said, we just didn't take pictures while we were working. Like, we just didn't think about it, but now I wish I had some. And he just talked about it and said people would always come up and say, what is this? What movie is this reference to? Yeah. You'd have to explain.
Oh.
But 4 years, I mean, that's a pretty long time, considering I'd never heard of it till recently.
Gurgie, which is sad. The sidekick dog man
Yeah, I don't know what he is. He's got like a mustache.
It's a thing. But he really is. You were the one that put on Twitter that he looked like
Geraldo Rivera.
Oh yeah.
Oh my gosh. The whole time I was watching the movie, I'm like, he looks like someone. Who does he look like? And then I think I Googled old man mustache. Old man actor mustache. And old I finally man. Saw it. I was like, yeah, that's him. It's Geraldo.
Or Geraldo.
Geraldo.
English speakers. It's really kind of sad because Gergi really is like an honorable character. Like, he sacrifices himself. Spoiler. He sacrifices himself at the end, you know, and saves the day.
He redeems himself. He's a little annoying at first. And not like in a, oh, that little mischievous, like, now he needs to leave. Like, who is this?
Like in that Olaf kind of way.
No, I like Olaf.
Okay.
Are you for, do you really for real not like Olaf?
No, I do. I'm just over him.
Oh, okay. Well, that, yeah, for sure. But we're not to the 2010s yet, so we'll get there. I did see a picture of Taran. However they say it. And Elon, like they have the British accents, you know.
You said that so dramatically.
Taran. And the girl. Yeah. Anyway, I saw pictures of them.
Elonwy.
Why did they have horrible names? Like, seriously. Why can't he be like Fred? This is ridiculous. Yeah, that's right.
From the book, from the mythology. It's like Lord of the Rings stuff.
But like even the town, what's it called? The nation or whatever? Prebane?
Oh, Prydain. Yeah,
Prydain. Anyway, I did see them as meet and greet characters, but I don't know how long that lasted.
I think, now again, this is extreme armchair imagineering, but if we were forced to bring the Black Cauldron to the parks in some way with unlimited funds, I think a nice dark ride of the Black Cauldron would be fun because you could go from, you know, the pig pen in the beginning to the castle to where they're enchained and then, you know,
gosh,
all that
kids
kind of...
would be screaming in that. Listen, the Snow White scary adventure scared me. The Black Cauldron is definitely going to scare some
Disney
kids.
Disney ever wanted to do something a little darker for Halloween, and I just mean a little darker. Why, the Horned King is untapped. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a scary villain that's mysterious. I don't know. I don't tap into that for something.
Well, he doesn't sell merchandise, but he could. I think you're right. If you sell him the right way, he could.
With the Satanists.
Yeah.
Ooh. Yeah. The Satanist crowd at Disney World loves
the same folks buying the Jack Skellington t-shirts.
Maybe. I think Gergi is probably the most memorable and adorable character from the film. But anyway.
Well, I like to write Black Cauldron fan fiction in my free time, so you can look that up on our website.
And...
Is it suitable for all ages?
Well, it's been compared to 50 Shades of Grey, so I'll just leave it at that.
Oh. Are you shipping Elonwy and Gergi?
Am I what?
Shipping? Like hooking them up as a couple? Never
that
mind.
That word shipping?
Yeah.
Is that a thing?
Yeah, like, oh, come on, you know. Like
we work in churches, Derek. We don't know your sexual...
Yeah, like Harry Potter fan fiction, how people shipped, or they still ship, Hermione and Harry.
As in, like, they're turning relationship
like relationship? Or like Lavender and Parvati, whatever her name is.
Like relationship?
Yeah, like they hook them up.
Oh, I've never heard that term in my life.
They shortened the word relationship and...
Exactly, yeah, like I ship them. Never mind.
Well, I have shipped the pig and Taran. It's kind of complicated.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
I have shipped a guitar for the lead singer of Winger before.
Oh, fun facts.
When you worked at UPS
store. The pack and ship prop.
Oh, my gosh. You
I feel like we're
man.
Really revealing a lot about ourselves on this podcast.
What is that? What do you mean? Let me turn my hearing aid. Get on the MySpace and look that up.
Calm down, Gergi.
MySpace.
Anyway, we move from 1985 to 1986 to yet another film that has so few references in the park.
Oh, no. But we're beginning to climb out of the valley.
Okay. All right.
This is the first step.
Okay. What's the film?
The Great Mouse Detective.
Nope. Oliver and Company.
No, it's definitely the Great Mouse Detective. Yeah, yeah. With Basil and Rattigan, who's not a rat.
You've been known, Derek, to say that this was one of your favorites as a child.
No. You put words in my mouth. I said I used to watch it all the time because it was one of the few we had. I was never in love with it.
I even bought it for you for Christmas. I feel bad now.
I know. Hey, listen, you saved me having to rent it for $4 on iTunes last week when I watched it again because I just popped in the DVD. Oh,
there you go. Yeah. I liked this one as a child.
I mean, I didn't hate it, but like yet another dark one that wasn't one where I was like, oh, I can't wait to put this in the VCR and watch again.
Now, did this one flop as well?
No, I believe it was considered a box office success. However, it was not to the level that
now let me ask you a question. Right.
It was nowhere near like 101 Dalmatians and Jungle Book in the late 60s.
This is completely shooting it out there. I don't know how the storyline went, but it seems to me that with the crop of new animators that were working with Black Cauldron and it flopped, and then The Great Mouse Detective, and you say it was a quote-unquote success, but it didn't quite reach the standards of, you know, Disney classic animation.
Yeah, it had it had a $14 million budget, and it made $25 million at the box office. So.
Okay.
Yeah. It seems like after these two movies, especially after Black Cauldron, after this one, a lot of those animators are either fired by Disney, or especially after Black Cauldron, you said there was a massive downsizing and outcasting. And those animators clearly go somewhere else. Because if you look at the look and the timbre of these films and the music of these films, and then you go and watch Fievel or Anastasia, those films, you can see that I think it feels like those animators worked on the same, like those are the same animators.
Definitely. And it's in the 80s that Don Bluth, who was a animator at Disney, left and started his own studio, which made Fievel and all those.
So, it has that kind of feel to it.
Definitely.
And even that Radigan, that blasted Chipmunks movie, which I still love. The Alvin and the Chipmunks adventure movie. Remember that one?
The animated one, not the CGI
stuff. Yeah, the animated one.
Well, you mentioned the music. When I watched this last weekend, and the music is straight out of Epcot. Like, as I was listening, I was researching the guy. Like, he had to have written music for Future World because it sounds just like it. He didn't, but...
Huh.
It's that 80s, like, do-do-do-do-do, like, the upbeat, but also, like, very hopeful.
Piano melodies.
Yeah.
Like, the beginning of Who's the Boss.
Here's another instance where Disney had a good idea based off a book, because I'm sure when they... threw this out, they're like, it's Sherlock Holmes, everybody likes Sherlock Holmes, but it's with mice and people, you know, for kids and da da da, and so on paper it sounded good, but unfortunately I feel like they just didn't flush it out. Because I mean, look how popular Benedict Cumberbatch's Sherlock is right now. People like this character, they like the idea. I just don't think that they connected it well enough in the 1980s.
I'd agree with that. It does have a lot of fun gags. Like, they actually live under the real Sherlock and Watson, because there's a scene where you see, like, the humans talking to each other, Sherlock and Watson. And I really like the scene where they're trapped in the mousetrap, and he does, like, all the thinking in his head to get them out of it. Like, that's typical Sherlock Holmes. But yeah, you're right. There's so many things that just don't work about the film, which is unfortunate.
And I find the little girl to be annoying.
Yeah, oh, yeah. I agree with that.
There just wasn't a lot... This is very meta. Stick with me. There wasn't a lot in the 80s. Something about people in the 80s did not attach to things. Maybe it is the coming off of drugs and into reality.
Everybody was on drugs, man.
They're coming off of them in the 80s.
Oh, okay.
People are growing up. You know, the 60s are over. Now we're in the era of Reagan. You know, they're all getting old and conservative. And things are evening out. People just don't see... When you watch movies from the 80s, Goonies, that seems to be the only one I can think of right now. Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. There seems to be like an emotional disconnect with people. There just wasn't a lot of sentimentalism then. So it makes sense that there just wasn't things that people latched onto. So you have something like this, it's like, that's a good movie.
But on the other hand, I'm gonna counter that by saying, but then around the same time you have, like I said, Fievel, and you have Land Before Time, and these are overly sentimental films.
Yeah, that's true.
Really tug on your heartstrings. I mean,
in retrospect.
In retrospect, I mean, but even as a kid, I remember like in Land Before Time when the mom dies, I remember being torn up about that as a kid, you know.
I remember wanting Sarah to die.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's get to the parks. Once again, I cannot think of anything except I remember earlier this year, they have the Easter egg. They paint Easter eggs at the Grand Floridian Resort. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I remember several people retweeted this because it was so rare that there was a Great Mouse Detective one.
Oh.
But of course, that just lasts like a couple weeks, so obviously it's not that big a deal. But I remember being like, hey, the Great Mouse, because it had Radigan on it, and it had Basil and the girl, I'm pretty sure. Had a lot going on, but other than that,
nope.
Yeah,
and the sad thing is, the way our generation is with our nostalgia, they really could bring back some stuff, mm-hmm. even from movies like this, and at least put little things like that Easter egg. Like, who would have thought people would have got excited about Easter egg? But it's something from our childhood that we remember that we have an attachment to. Mm-hmm. So bring back a little more, Disney.
There's also a video on YouTube of the 1992 Easter parade on Main Street. And Basil and Radigan are in a car. They're like the grand marshals of the parade. But
redo that Agent P thing with Great Mouse Detective. It fits very well there.
That's a really good idea.
There we go. Genius. You're welcome. Send me my check, Disney.
All right, so we've done Fox and the Hound, Black Cauldron, Great Mouse Detective, none of which have references in the parks today. And now we get to a fourth one, maybe, unless I'm mistaken. And that is something Jeremy alluded to earlier, Oliver and Company in 1988.
Again, Disney started out, this is great. It's Charles Dickens. It's Oliver Twist, you know, the Artful Dodger. Oh, man, it's going to be great. And again, a decent movie. I remember loving this movie as a child.
I liked it.
I honestly
didn't see it until I was in college.
I didn't see it until yesterday.
Oh, really?
And I liked it. I mean, I didn't love it, but
the animation is so flat. Like, you don't realize how flat it is until you watch it as an adult. And
the
you're
scenes
like,
of New York City from far away, it looked like I sketched it on a sketch pad. It is.
But you know what? When I started watching this film, Derek, is when we were about to go to New York City in college. And that's when I bought that. I think they had just released it, and I bought it and was watching it. And it kind of became the soundtrack of New York City.
Yeah. See, that's what I want to know. Even if you're not going to include the characters or anything, why not at least have this music playing? Like, I could totally see Why Should I Worry being just like an instrumental played during some fireworks show or something. I don't know.
Or they even have the streets of New York at Hollywood Studios, or at least we currently do. I don't know if we will.
I don't want to steal it from you, Jeremy. You go ahead and say your thing.
Well, I was going to say the music from a New Yorker himself, Billy Joel,
yeah.
Which, you know, is a kind of a precursor. A precursor to, like, your Phil Collins and Sting, who later comes, you know, in the early 2000s. But the music carried by Billy Joel throughout the movie. Plus, you have some fun voices like Cheech Marin.
Right.
And isn't Bette Midler a voice in there as well?
Bette Midler is Georgette.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, it's the story of Oliver Twist set in New York City, played by kittens and dogs.
Right. And some humans.
And a few humans, you're right, yes.
Like I said, I enjoyed it from start to finish. I would not rank it in my top whatever, but
this is totally going back into the vaults of your mind. But I remember McDonald's having like Christmas ornaments. Do you remember this, Matt?
Yes.
With Oliver and Dodger, and they were like plush little Christmas ornaments, and they were wearing like a Santa Claus hat.
Yes. Now, granted, I would have only been – you would have been like two.
That's why I'm surprised I remember this because
I
was
at least three.
But I remember
that specifically.
My grandma having – and I remember seeing the commercials on TV.
And I also remember, as is the case with a lot of these films, it's funny how often we reference these, how important they are in archiving lost Disney films to us. And I remember glimpses of this film on some of the sing-along videos.
Yes.
And they never had one of the songs from this film on there, but they would show clips of it. And I was always like, what is that movie? Kind of like we said with Song of the South. Like, what is that?
Mm-hmm.
It's Oliver and Company.
God bless those sing-along videos. Those
seriously.
If you walked into music class in elementary school and there was a TV, you knew it was going to be a Disney sing-along day, and that was a good day.
Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed every song from this film. In fact, I tried to look up the soundtrack on Apple Music, and it's not available. And I have found every other album I've looked for on Apple Music, and it's not on there. So I don't know what's going on with this movie. But about a month ago, Disney Parks blog, you may have seen on Twitter, they posted like a little historical thing, and they had a picture of a parade float. I don't know if it was like an official float or if it was kind of like what they did with Inside Out this year, where it just ran for a limited time before a big parade. But it had Georgette, Dodger, Tito, and Penny. It had like a 25-year-old girl playing Penny.
Naturally.
And, of course. So I thought that was kind of cool, but...
Fun reaching way back here. Fun fact. Do you know who is the voice of Oliver?
No. Yes, I do.
I just looked at it.
Joey Lawrence.
Joey Lawrence. Yep. That's crazy. He was just a little guy.
You can hear it, yeah.
Whoa. Yeah, it made money, too. $74 million at the box office. So.
Okay. Honestly, it was like, hey, this movie's lighthearted and fun compared to the last three I just watched. So
yeah. It's a step in the right direction. Yeah. Another step up the mountain.
Yeah.
Well, before we move on to the next film, even though this is not a Disney animated film, I think we should do respect and at least mention it. And that is around this time, 88, I believe, 87, somewhere in there, was Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Which was a joint project of lots of different studios, Warner Brothers and Disney and all kinds of things. But Roger Rabbit played a huge part in the opening of Hollywood Studios. And in fact, there was a lot of talk that he was going to be the new Mickey Mouse for the company, as far as being the face of the company and kind of this fresh face for a new generation kind of a thing. But that all kind of petered out. But when you see... some of the early Hollywood Studios stuff, and even in Spectro Magic, you have Roger Rabbit. So
you used to.
He
was replaced with Genie. If you've ever seen Spectro Magic, the scene where Genie is your maestro, or not your maestro, your conductor, that used to be Roger Rabbit.
Mm. Yeah. And you can still see a little trace of Roger Rabbit. I think he has a billboard still at Hollywood Studios.
He has got that window where his silhouette.
In the window.
And
yeah.
He's remember when we stayed at Pop Century? He's the giant icon.
That's right.
In the 80s section.
Which he totally represents the 80s.
You know, absolutely.
Pee Wee Herman, you know, it's like, that's the 80s.
Well, I read that one of the reasons he's not represented that much now is because of what you said about this being under Warner Brothers and also under Steven Spielberg's company, Amblin Entertainment. And I think Disney was probably like, listen, if they're going to get money off of the, if we have to share the profits from this, let's just go to our other characters who we get 100% of the profits from, you know. Mm-hmm. Like the characters that they're about to release, let's focus on them instead of losing money with this guy. But yeah, I had read that the trolley tracks that are on Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood Studios were for a planned Roger Rabbit attraction, and that they decided not to do it, but the tracks are still there. Huh. Now that's your boy Jim Corcus, so I can't be sure it's entirely correct.
Oh, Jimmy.
But you still have Roger Rabbit's cartoon spin or whatever out at Disneyland.
Toontown.
So. Well, I mean, all of Toontown was inspired by the Toontown that's in Roger Rabbit.
So. I don't know about you guys, but I remember there was one of the Roger Rabbit shorts before Honey, I Shrunk the Kids on the VHS.
Yeah.
I don't know if y'all watched that.
Baby Herman.
With Baby Herman. And I remember my mom did not like it. She kind of looked at it.
And cigar.
It was kind of like The Simpsons. Like, that's a cartoon you're not supposed to watch.
Yeah.
But anywho.
Do you remember Roger Rabbit in Spectro Magic, Matt?
I do, and when you listen to some versions that you can still find, you can still hear him.
The version I have still has Roger Rabbit.
Really? Okay, mine has Genie. Interesting. All right, well, that brings us to the final film of the 80s, which, let me tell you, after watching all of these in a row, was a breath of fresh air, and that is The Little Mermaid, the classic... You sound just like Ariel. It's amazing.
Quiet, Steve.
Yeah. No, but like I said, this was like, yes, this is what Disney is supposed to be. There's a reason this was the first quote-unquote hit since, I think we said 101 Dalmatians. It was also the first Disney princess since Aurora, which was 59, 40 years before. Like, this movie was huge when it came out. I didn't see this in the theater. I mean, I would have only been two, but I definitely remember this being one of the ones from my childhood that we watched often. And reading back on some of this stuff now, I saw that The Little Mermaid is kind of like what Frozen is now, except one of the reasons Frozen's even more so like that now is because they learned from The Little Mermaid. Girls wanted Ariel merchandise like crazy when this movie came out, and they just didn't have enough of it. And it was in high demand constantly, and by like November, they'd run out of all the stuff for Christmas, all the dolls and everything. And so I think one of the reasons that they are so quick to put stuff out for Frozen is they don't want to, run into that problem again where everybody wants it and they don't have anything to give them.
Well, they even did kind of run into that. If you remember, like a lot of the Disney stores across the country didn't have Frozen merchandise, so they ran out of it.
Oh, that's right. Like the Elsa dresses. Everybody wanted one of those.
Yeah, and they would do lotteries just to buy the dress. Mm-hmm. I was like, unbelievable.
So imagine it's even worse for Little Mermaid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this to me, this film, especially when you watch that documentary, Waking Sleeping Beauty, you'll see, this film was just like the perfect storm. Like, it just, all these good things came together. The animators were like starving and wanting something fresh. They brought in Howard Ashman and Alan Menken, who were Broadway vets, who were just geniuses, in my opinion. And they did the music and helped with the story. You had kind of the freedom from the company to do what they wanted to do because there was no expectations really after as many flops as they had. So they were able to just let those creative juices go and come up with this just fantastic product kind of a thing.
The animation is so good. Just, I mean, it holds up. I mean, you can tell it's 80s, but like just watching it recently, her hair, how it floats in the water, every bit of it is just so good and impressive. And like you said, the music, part of me wants to say the music makes this film, the way certain themes just get played throughout.
Oh, it does.
And Under the Sea is like a show-stopping number that there's a reason it gets played in every single parade Disney has made since 1989.
Use the illustration that I used earlier of, you know, being in the valley and climbing back up the mountain. It's like they boarded the cable car at this point and got up really quickly to the top because, everything, it's almost as if they have been experimenting for 30 years and not finding their niche. And then they said, hey, what did we used to do that worked really well?
Exactly.
There was that princess thing with Snow White and Cinderella and Sleeping Beauty. Let's try to do something like that again.
Mm-hmm.
And tapped into just classic Disney storytelling minus, I mean, I'm all for progress and innovation and moving forward and trying new things, but let's just do something we know we can do and do it well.
Well, and to the credit of Roy E. Disney, he really clung to that as well, and he really was about, hey, animation is our bread and butter, and we need to, you know, we can explore, but we can't forget who we are, you know, and that really, you know, brought it back. I love bringing in Howard Ashman and Alan Menken. They were able to tell stories through musicals in the same way that you would on Broadway. And so that was kind of their principle. Did you ever hear the story about how Part of Your World almost got cut?
I did.
Yeah, they were showing it to a special screening, a preview to a bunch of children, and Jeffrey Katzenberg was there. And apparently during Part of Your World,
his name keeps popping up.
Yeah. Apparently during the Part of Your World scene, a child kicked over his popcorn. And so there was some wrestling trying to clean that up and blah, blah, blah. Wrestling, not wrestling, but anyways.
you dare knock down my popcorn. Get over here, kid.
Elbow drop. Anyways.
Kyle Driver, brother.
Anyways, after that, Jeffrey Katzenberg was like, we got to get rid of that song. It's boring. The kids don't like it. And pretty much everybody, you know, on the project was like, no, 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 no. Please reconsider. There's no way. And thankfully now he looks back at it and was like, I was wrong. You know, clearly I almost made a terrible mistake there. But
That theme is played throughout the whole movie because if you remember, like, Eric keeps playing it on his flute or his recorder.
His recorder from elementary school.
Exactly. Because he's like, where is this girl?
Well, that's a principle that Howard Ashman brought out. He said in almost every musical that's ever been played, the leading lady early in the evening, usually the second or third song, she sits down on an object and she sings about what her heart desires
or
what she truly wants out of life. Well, usually it's the she. And then you root for her or him to get it for the rest of the show. Mm. And so really Part of Your World is really what Matt said, those other films lack that emotional connection. that's on Party World, that connects us to Ariel. And, you know, we all root for her to get her wish.
Mm-hmm. I said he because I was thinking Aladdin, where he does one jump ahead reprise. And
And Belle, when she sings about how she wants something more than this provincial life.
Very good.
That's in the 90s.
Yeah.
Right, right.
A little preview for the next one.
Now, you mentioned Waking Sleeping Beauty. It's been a while since I've seen it, but was this the film that they considered the start of that renaissance that woke Sleeping Beauty?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, I assumed, but this was
Little Mermaid all the way through, I think, Hercules is considered the Disney renaissance, if you would.
Yeah, so the Waking Sleeping Beauty only to go back to sleep in about 6 years.
Well, you know.
No, it's about 11.
Wake back up. But then you've got... Oh, we're getting ahead of ourselves. Then you got a good 15-year jump between that sleep and the next.
No.
No, not quite that long, but...
Yeah, you got little moments of sleepwalking in between. But,
so Tarzan sleepwalking.
No,
full
Tarzan is vomit.
No.
We'll get there. Next decade. When I'll see you next decade.
That's right. That's right.
There's going to be some wrestling, brothers.
Yeah. Okay, so The Little Mermaid. Hollywood Studios opened in 89, yes?
Yes.
So the year this movie came out. 3 years later was when they opened Voyage of the Little Mermaid in 92, which is still there to this day. That is, I will say unfortunately, I will agree, but that show still gets people to watch it. Maybe because it's the only Little Mermaid thing there, but still, 23 years, the exact same show with the puppets and the black lights and the rain, and it's still there, so obviously...
Sometimes without the rain.
Right, right. Sometimes it doesn't work.
Because that's when you realize this show sucks.
Well, it's not my favorite.
It also tells you the staying power of this film that they just got a new attraction on both coasts. Mm-hmm. And then the last, 3 years?
And Disney World facade of that attraction blows the DCA one out of the water.
Oh, yeah. The DCA one's like, hey, I'm going to go in here and buy a corn dog. Oh, it's an attraction.
No,
wow.
It's more like an opera house or something. I don't know. But the Eric's Castle is amazing in Disney World. I love that facade. So cool. And it's just like the movie, too.
Yeah.
But like I alluded to earlier, they cannot make a show, fireworks, parade, anything without including Little Mermaid. It's like they just can't help themselves. And I get it, but part of me would love to have nods to other films sometimes, but...
Well, I think it goes back to what I said. Our generation is a very nostalgic generation. So you have people our age who grew up with it. Plus, you have little kids even today that are just discovering the film for the first time and falling in love with Ariel and Eric and Flounder and all of them. So the movie definitely is profitable for the company and has some lasting power.
Yeah. Besides those attractions, I also think of Art of Animation, which has an entire Little Mermaid section with a giant Triton and giant Ariel and all the fish, and it's actually really cool, but it's very immersive. So if you don't like Little Mermaid, do not stay there.
And it has my favorite villain of all Disney films.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
Ursula. I love her. Love her. Love her.
Which is a shame that they can't really include her in the parks more than they can just because of the way she is.
Yeah.
I mean, like, physically, the way she is.
Yeah.
You just can't have an octopus walking around the park.
And she's fat.
Right.
I don't know what that means. No, I love her. This will not surprise you all, but I have a plush Ursula on my couch.
Yep.
Jaw dropped.
Which I heard your jab at me last week, Matt, when I wasn't here. The plush jab.
Oh, yes. Jeremy's weeping.
This does have a lot of references, though, because the more I think about it, the more I think of, like, the Princess Medley in Fantasmic. PhilharMagic, Part of Your World, a song in that.
She's been in pretty much every parade that's ever been made at the Magic Kingdom.
Ariel's Grotto is an entire restaurant in Disney California Adventure. Mm-hmm. And it's Matt's favorite place to meet a character in Disney World.
No.
She meets at the Cinderella's Royal Table with her legs, obviously. Mm-hmm. She just flops around the restaurant. Can you come to me, please? It's just kind of easy.
Awesome. I think she's probably represented. Well, is there any Little Mermaid references in Animal Kingdom?
No,
I can't think of any.
So three of the four parks.
What's Epcot?
She's at Oshkosh.
Oh, that's right. Whatever.
Oshkoshoshbegosh.
Yeah. That's true. That's true. There's a whole mermaid lagoon, like an entire land in Tokyo.
Mm.
So it's a popular movie. And I mean, I got to give it to it. It deserves it. It's a good one.
And it gave the company the kick in the pants it needed to. I mean, think about what we would not have currently if it was not for The Little Mermaid. We're letting that soak in for a second.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this spawned like three more Disney princess movies in the next so many years, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Well, as I was thinking about these movies, they're not my favorites by any means, the 80s in general. And as I started thinking about it, I thought, are there so few references in the parks because these movies just were flops and they aren't well loved? Or do people not love these movies because there are no references, like they're not referenced anymore today? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's the classic, do I tell people what they should like or do I let people tell me what they like?
Yeah. And I think watching them back, it was the first one that I just, there are no references in the parks because there are much better films to represent. But I do wonder if I saw these more and more around when I went to the parks, if I'd be like, oh, I like that. That's a good movie. I like that one. You know?
Yeah.
Anyway, any final thoughts you guys have about the movies of the 80s? Anything you want them to bring from Great Mouse Detective, Oliver and Company, anything like that? Or do you think it's just as it should be?
I still think that if you're going to have The Streets of New York in Hollywood Studios, in the revamp, whenever that comes, putting some kind of at least a reference to Oliver and Company would be nice there.
Mm-hmm.
I still think you could do the adventure in Epcot with Great Mouse Detective. And I still think that something, some character-related thing with Fox and the Hound at Animal Kingdom would be appropriate.
Hmm.
Because think about it, it's all about hunting and things. That would be a nice thing for
life.
Oh.
For conservation.
They could have a meet and greet with Todd and old Cecil the Lion.
No, they can't.
Time to wrap this up.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's the 80s. When we come back and do the 90s, I think we'll have a lot more to talk about. So until that time, go follow us on social media. Please review us on iTunes and iTunes. Yeah, iTunes. It's a new app where people ship relationships. But go review us over there. We'd really appreciate it. And be sure to get your orders for t-shirts to us before Monday, August 17th. Until next time, we will see you later.
Take a little time to find the magic in every day.
TTFN, ta-ta for now.